we see step pyramids, we see equinoxes, level platforms, advanced mathematics, advanced engineering, advanced architecture. It all just goes bing, like just comes out of nowhere. Comes out of nowhere. There is no pre-existing culture. My theory, and it's a theory, is this is fallen angel technology. They come down, they are worshiped as gods because they can manipulate space, time, matter, and energy in ways that normal human beings, even today, can't do. But you go back 4,000, 5,000 years ago, and it's like, these are the gods. About 28 of them sequenced. Out of the sequencing, many of them, about half of them, showed a Middle Eastern / European origin. That rewrites history. Mm-hmm. But they don't like because it's not the history that they want.
Hello, and welcome to the Spirit Box Podcast, where we explore folklore, magic, the world of the spirits, and everything in between. Now, for those of you who have followed my photographic work for some time, you'll know that I spent a lot of time visiting some of the strange sites associated with ancient prehistory, controversial prehistory, those being Göbekli Tepe, the Bosnian Pyramid, and the Plain of Jars in Laos. I've always been fascinated by the idea that prehistory is a real mystery and one we have limited understanding of, that perhaps the actual story of history is far more complex, far more supernatural, and less linear than we are taught to believe. Now, my next guest, L.A. Marzulli, is an author, lecturer, and filmmaker in this particular area. He's penned 13 books, including the Nephilim trilogy, which made the CBA bestsellers list. His book series On the Trail of the Nephilim, volumes 1 and 2, are full-color oversized volumes which reveal startling evidence of the mass cover-up which he believes to be the remains of the Nephilim, the giants mentioned in the Bible. LA teamed up with film producer Richard Shaw to create the Watcher series, which grew into an 11-episode catalogue. One of those installments, Watcher 7, UFO Physical Evidence, won both the UFO Best Film and People's Choice Award at the UFO Congress in 2014. Now, Marzulli created a team that legally extracted material for DNA testing from the enigmatic elongated skulls found in Peru, the so-called Paracas skulls. Now, we also get into the lunar cycle and the 18-year lunar cycle and its relationship with the Great Mounds of North America. LA poses the question, who built the Great Mounds? We talk about the Paracas skulls in some detail towards the end of the hour, so you might want to watch the YouTube version because LA shows and demonstrates with the cast of a Paracas skull that he has in his possession to show its distinct differences from a human skull. Now, better strap in for this one, kiddos, because this is a wild one. Enjoy! L.A. Marzulli, it is an absolute pleasure to welcome you to the Spirit Box. Thank you for coming along.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. For those of my listeners who aren't, say, familiar with your work, could you tell them a little bit about yourself?
I'm a Frank supernaturalist. I believe in a biblical prophetic worldview. I'm the author of 13 books, working on number 14, and either directed or co-produced 21 films.
Fantastic.
Way to go.
Yeah, good. I like that. I appreciate being proud of good achievements. Absolutely. So one of the reasons I'm delighted to have you here today is your work on giants. It's a subject matter and area that I've always found really fascinating. And indeed I've watched a lot of your work. Those said films you referred to, I've watched and what I'd really love to do is explore some of your latest ideas and kind of the areas of interest and the areas of research, particularly around the mound builders of the United States.
Well, yeah. You know, it's incredibly enigmatic, and there are The powers that be, let me say this, I say this every single show, that there is a hidden history that has been deliberately obfuscated from the peoples of the world. And that's why I am on the trail of a Nephilim. Wherever you go, there's a narrative that's being pushed. The narrative is a Darwinian narrative where we just evolved out of, you know, who knows what. Nobody knows. It's never been proven. It's just a theory, but it's accepted in the scientific community for the most part in academia as an absolute fact. I take umbrage with that. Show me. And they'll trot out something like the Piltdown Man, and then 50 years later they go, oops, it was a hoax. Sorry about that. So what's the truth? What's the truth? Did all of this just happen accidentally? Or there is a creator someplace, you know, that designed us? Or, as the ancient alien theorists every Friday on the History Channel loudly proclaim, ancient astronaut theorists, that we were seeded here, panspermia. We were seeded here by an extraterrestrial race millions of years ago or thousands of years ago, whatever. The bottom line is nobody knows. Nobody knows what this is or where we are. Nobody. It's all theory. You can't prove anything. So with that in mind, when I go down with Sacsayhuaman or Ollantaytambo in Peru, and I look at these megalithic, oh, stop emailing me already. That's the trouble. You do a Zoom and everybody's texting and emailing and leave me alone, go away. So I'm down in Peru, and I'll never forget the first time I was here. And Brian Forrester, a colleague and friend, brought us over. You know, there's a lot of different ways to access the site. He brought us in the back way, so we're way up looking down, and we just sat there with our jaws on the ground. We couldn't believe it. Huge cyclopean megalithic stones, you know, with polygonal angles. And then we ran down and we got to the wall and we filmed there. And I filmed there numerous times. But the bottom line is this, that if you think for a second that the Inca built this, think again. They had nothing to do with it. And yet this is the narrative that is force fed down everybody's throat by the Peruvian government. Well, the Inca were master stone builders. Oh, really? Well, can you show us how they did that? Well, we really can't. We don't know how, but the Inca did it. And this is what we see over and over and over again. Go north to the mound builders, and it's the same nonsense. Oh, the Native Americans built this. Oh, really? So when the first white settlers reached Ohio, and they came into what is now Newark, Ohio, to the Great Circle Mound, and also the Octagon Mound, they asked the Native Americans who were there, who built this? Native Americans, First Nation people said, we don't know, it was here when we got here. So this is what we get. This is what we get. And we get it over and over and over and over again. It's the same narrative wherever you go, that, oh, the Inca built it. Oh, Native Americans built it. But when you actually drill down into it, you find that, wait a minute. And this is, to me, the smoking gun in all these sites. Many of the sites are built on an 18 and a half year lunar cycle. So in other words, let's say you and I descended to Earth a couple thousand years ago. Here we are. Hey, planet Earth, pretty cool. What's what do you got to eat here, right? And we look at the moon and we go, wow, that's pretty cool. The next night we get up and look at the moon again and we realize it looks like it's in a different position. And then you go, well, why don't we see if we can track this thing? Jolly good. So the moon comes up, we take a stake, dink, 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 pound the stake in the ground. The moon descends and disappears, pound another stake, day one. Day two, moon comes up in a different place, pound another stake, dink, 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 sets in a different place. This goes on for about 20 days. Then a rainstorm comes in and we can't see the moon for 5 days. Now what? Got to start all over again. The lunar cycle is the smoking gun because it is 18 and a half years, 18 and a half years cycle. And how would you crunch the data? How would you know where you came in on the cycle? Are you in year five, year 17, year one? You don't know. And then you've got to figure out a way of crunching the data. And all you've got is sticks and animal hides and some chalk roll or some, you know, some sort of writing utensil. How do you crunch the data over 18 and a half years? Moreover, how does the weather cooperate for 18 and a half years? And you don't know it's in 18 and a half. What if you go 10 years and go, surely we were at the end? And you go, I don't know. How would you crunch the data? This is the smoking gun, the elephant in the room that nobody addresses. However, the Book of Enoch does. Ancient texts found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, pseudepigraphical text attributed to Enoch, but not necessarily written by him. We don't know who wrote it. He gives us an amplification of the days of Noah, of the antediluvian world, of what happened before the great flood. And by the way, every single culture on the planet has a flood story. So something happened. It's a little different, but the Chinese have a flood story, for crying out loud. And they have nothing to do with anything as far as Christianity or anything else. They got a freaking flood story. So how does that work? So all we know is that this fallen angel, I hate that term because angel just means messenger. That's what it means. So this entity, this messenger, comes down and hands this information to mankind, just gives it to him, teaches man the cycle of the progression of the moon and the equinoxes and the solstices. And by the way, all these sites are obsessed with the 18 and a half year lunar cycle, the solstices, the equinoxes. They are literally obsessed with it. So that's sort of a nexus of the film. And I don't know what to tell you. I mean, there is a hidden history that has been deliberately obfuscated for the peoples of the world.
And so in terms of the hidden history and I guess and the identity of the mound builders, where do you stand on, say, the recent work around the Denevisians? Is that an area that you've explored?
The whole idea with, and typical of archaeology, they find one tooth and one bone. And from that, they construct an entire, and it looks kind of, you know, I'm a Denisovan. I'm not sure what that looks like, but you know, we're just going to give it over to the art department, and they're going to give us some sort of like a half ape Cro-Magnon thing. I mean, give me a freaking break, guys. Give me a freaking quit pulling our chains here. We're not that stupid, okay? You know, we don't know what they look like. Quit giving it. I'll do this whole picture of it with a spear and a loincloth. It's like, oh my God, you have no idea what you're looking at, none. So quit telling us that you do when you don't. Quit lying to us, for crying out loud. We've all had it up to here. How I really feel about it.
Yeah, exactly. Stop sitting on the fence here.
Sorry.
So in terms of like the identity of the builders and whoever they may be, you're seeing this as a line that's come down through Enoch, or is referred to in the Book of Enoch, the Watchers.
It is the Watchers. It is fallen. Look, when you're in Sacsayhuaman, I've been down here about, I don't know, three or four times at Sacsayhuaman, and yeah, I'm not a tour guide, but I have taken tours down there a couple of times, and I touch the stones behind me, and I go, when you come up here, and you touch the stones, you are touching the fingerprints of a supernatural, because we have no idea how this was done. None, absolutely none. And nor does the Peruvian government or anybody else. It's hysterical. Well, the Inca moved the 80-ton stone. Well, how did they do that? Well, we really don't know, but they moved them because it's here. It's circular, it's straw man argument. Well, they had to have moved them because we're here. That's called a straw man argument. The bottom line is you have no flipping idea in a month of Sundays how these guys did it. And whoever did it took all the machinery and tools with them. Something is going on here. Something, and you know, how do you move an 80-ton stone? Well, you can do it today with a crane, but then make polygonal shapes and add 40-ton stones on top of that? How do you do all this? They do it because they can do it. And whoever did it took the technology with them. This is why I call it fallen angel technology, Nephilim architecture. That's what it is. You know, but you can't, unless you hold the worldview that I hold, you'll never get there. You'll never solve the riddle. You won't, because you're always looking, well, maybe it was the extraterrestrials that did it. You know, maybe it was, if you're an archaeologist, well, maybe the Inca has some secret tools that we just don't know about. It's like Bullwinkle and Rocky, Rocky and Bullwinkle. It's like, just make it up as we go along. You know, the bottom line is the moment we go into a supernatural worldview, everything changes, because we realize from the guidebook of a supernatural, i.e. the Bible, this kind of nonsense is going on all through the pages. All we read about is supernatural intervention from day one to the Book of Revelation. It's all supernatural. So as a Darwinist, if you're a Darwinist, and I'm not, You cannot embrace the supernatural. You can't do that because there is no supernatural. There is no creation. There is no God, no right, no wrong, no good, no evil, no heaven, no hell. Imagine if you can. So the bottom line is you can't. You can't go there. So you never solve the riddle. Well, it must be the Inca. It had to be the Hopewell. Get this. When they talk about the Hopewell and the Adena, once again, Hopewell is a farmer in the Americas, thousands of years after these mounds were constructed, and they named the whole culture after the Hopewell. How does that work? You know, I mean, it'd be like, I'm going to name this the Marzullis. I mean, it's like, what? They have no idea what these people call themselves. But when you go to a museum and you talk to a docent or you talk to an archaeologist, they'll tell you all about it. Oh, they were masters. They were Da Vinci's of dirt. I remember reading that one. They were Da Vinci's of dirt, talking to a tenured professor at a major university teaching archaeology. And I said, well, some of this dirt came from several miles away. So how did they move it? Dog sled. So let me get this straight. Let me try to get my head around it. The ground in Ohio was frozen approximately 4 to 5 months out of the year. These are hunter-gatherers, you know? So who's feeding the laborers? Hey, take your little lunchbox to work. And, you know, at 12 o'clock, you can sit down with the boys and have yourself a nice hot pastrami sandwich. Doesn't go that way. So who's feeding the workforce? And moreover, you know, are you trying to tell me seriously that they're taking basketfuls of dirt from 3 miles away by dog sled? it's just unbelievable. But they buy into it because if they don't buy into it, they lose their tenure at a university. They lose their head as an archaeologist in charge of a museum. And they promulgate the same narrative over and over. They're in an echo chamber. They just say the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. And that's what they do. Endlessly repeated.
So you mentioned the polygonal walls in Peru and remarkable structures as they are, and I think I've never been to South America, but I have seen some of the photographs that kind of show the pre-Inca polygonal walls, Inca structures, and then Spanish structures on top of it, and like this vast difference between the first category. But I have seen kind of references to similar polygonal walls around the world in different areas. What do you think of that? Do you credit that to the same group, the Watchers?
What we're looking at, and this is where it gets incredibly enigmatic, very mysterious. Let's go to Peru again. There's the oldest city in the Americas. It's called Corral. It's about 5,000 years old. It actually may be closer to 7,000. The dates keep sliding backwards. At first, they thought it was much more modern, like maybe 2,000, 3,000 years. All of a sudden, they did carbon-14 dating, and it pushes it back 5,000 years. Now they're pushing it back even further. There's no pre-existing culture. None. Absolutely none. And we see step pyramids. We see equinoxes, level platforms, advanced mathematics, advanced engineering, advanced architecture. It all just goes bing, like just comes out of nowhere. Comes out of nowhere. There is no pre-existing culture. Same thing in Mexico, Teotihuacan. The archaeologists call them the Teotihuacanos because they have no idea who these people were. Go further north, go into Chaco Canyon, the Anasazi. All of a sudden, no pre-existing culture, poof, there it is. Something is going on here. This knowledge is being dispensed, and it's global, it's everywhere, okay? My theory, and it's a theory, is this is fallen angel technology. They come down, they are worshiped as gods because they can manipulate space, time, matter, and energy in ways that normal human beings, even today, can't do. But you go back 4,000, 5,000 years ago, and it's like, these are the gods, and they enslave the people, they're worshiped, and they set up shop for a period of time. And then the great equalizer in the sky gets involved after a period of time. He lets it go, and then he gets involved. Proof text for that is when the pre-incarnate Christ appears to Abraham thousands of years ago, along with two other angels. The pre-incarnate Christ sends the two other angels to Sodom and Gomorrah. He's going to deal with them right now because of what's going on there. It's a Nephilim stronghold. They have mixed their seed with the seed of fallen angels. No, no, can't do that. That's why the destruction comes down. The Nephilim are there, and that's why it's not happening. So he says to Abraham, they're having a meal together. So Jesus says something which is incredibly telling. He says, well, I'm going to make you a great nation, which he does. You're going to go down to Egypt for 400 years until the sin of the Amorites comes into its fullness. What does that mean? What does that mean? Well, the Amorites are a Nephilim tribe. He allows 400 years, and then he brings Israel out of Egypt to go after them. So when you look at that, and we realize that no one knows who the Hopewell were. They have no idea. No one knows who the Adena were. And these mounds look different. The Adena mounds are really conical like this, really conical. And I've been there. I mean, I've been to a bunch of Adena mounds. The sides are like super steep. And it begs the question, well, okay, we're bringing in dirt in baskets, according to your theory. How are they compacted? No one ever talks about that. So if I had access to a mound, the first thing I would do would be to core drill in a place that we know has never been excavated. Take the core sample, take it to a geologist and go, what's the compaction on this thing? And if they find stuff that doesn't make any sense, in other words, well, you can do this in modernity, but you can't do it 3,000 years ago, then we have a real problem. But they don't do stuff like that. They just don't. Here, I'll give you another example. My team may have been the only team that went to the Great Circle Mound in Ohio. And I hired an independent engineer, not part of our team, and surveyor, okay, Todd Willis. So Todd goes in and he surveys this moat. So you say, well, how big is the moat? Well, first of all, the Newark Circle Mound is one of the largest in the world. And it encompasses, I don't know, 40 acres. It's huge. It's about 1,200 feet across. So it's really big. So he's down there with this little, you know, stick, and he's taking all the measurements. And the report is, well, basically it's flat. Basically the moat is flat. It's within 6 inches to a foot. And that can be attributed to erosion over thousands of years. Okay, that's fair. So I go, well, how did they do it in the ancient world? And the only thing you can come up with, well, they would have to have done it by water somehow. Okay, how do you bring the water in? How much water is it going to take? So, you know, you get things like this where the moat, for all practical purposes, is dead level. How did they get the water there? And we know that there was a creek within a couple hundred yards of it. And I'm going to bet that there's some sort of an underground pipeline, whether it's with rock or whatever, that fed the moat. So this thing must have looked unbelievable 3,000-4,000 years ago, when torchlight, no trees, torchlights are there. And the entrance, by the way, I'll tell you a story. The entrance, by the way, before it was destroyed, was more than likely two serpent heads. It's always the serpent. So I was at a conference about 10, 12 years ago. And I thought that, you know, my work with the Nephilim was pretty much done. I had written three novels about this, and I thought it was done. Okay. So my friend, Russ Dizdar, who passed away very unexpectedly from COVID, by the way, about 4 months ago, as did his wife 18 days later. Tragic. So Russ calls me up and he goes, Hey, LA, do you know where you're going? I go, yeah, Russ, I'm going to Newark, Ohio. He starts laughing. He goes, no, do you know where you're going? Russ, I'm going to Newark. Why, what's going on? He goes, Google Fritz Zimmerman, Fallen Angels in the Ohio Valley, the Nephilim Chronicles. I go, what? I Google, there's the book thing. I order it immediately, download it, voraciously read it on the plane. Because the next day I'm on a plane, so I'm reading the PDF on the plane. So by the time I get there, I'm kind of honing in on this thing. And I'm also trying to get a hold of Fritz Zimmerman. I'm emailing him. Contacted, he's not responding. He didn't respond for a couple of days. So I'm at the hotel. I'm doing my conference stuff. And I asked my driver on Saturday morning, I go, hey, where's this Great Circle Mound that I've been reading about? He goes, oh, we've been passing it the last couple of days. It's up here about a mile on the right. What? So sure enough, after a mile, I see the sign, NERC Earthworks. And I look over and there it is. And I go to my hotel. I mean, I do the thing. And on the way back, I go, look, tomorrow we got a short day. So on the way back around 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, drop me off here. Can you do that? And then pick me up around 5 or 6. He goes, sure. So the next day he drops me off. I'm the only person there. There's nobody there. It's like the decks are cleared for whatever reason. So I get the full impact of this thing. There's an asphalt pathway that leads from the parking lot up to the mound. So I start trudging up and I notice to my left is this very large earthen wall. But I still don't really, I know I'm in the circle mound. I've seen pictures from Fritz's book, but nothing does it justice until you're there with boots on the ground. I look to my right and there's a museum there. Of course, it's closed. And I make a left turn and I begin to walk to the entrance of the Great Circle Mound. And I freeze in my tracks. And every nerve ending is tingling, just like it is now retelling the story. And I'm hyperventilating. I'm going like this. I am transfixed, immobilized, riveted on what I am seeing. My eyes are darting around like this. And I realize it's one of those moments that I think few people ever get. Some people do get, but I was looking at the rest of my life. I was looking at what I was going to be doing with the rest of my life. And I mean, when I say I must have stood there for 4 minutes, 5 minutes, I don't know how long, time stopped. And it was absolutely one of those experiences that you can't duplicate, but it was just every nerve ending. The hair in the back of my neck stood up and I just was immobilized, just like, and hyperventilated. And I knew I was looking at the rest of my life, and that's what the rest of my life has been. You can see the set behind me with the elongated skulls, and there's Ralph Glidden right there. Hi, Ralph, 5'8". And in front of him, right in this picture below, is the 9-footer right out on Catalina Island, about 28 miles from me right now. That's what he found in 1919. So, you know, my theory is that they come down, they set up shop, and going back to Abraham or Sodom and Gomorrah, then he deals with them at some point. And there is another, Tim Alberino taught me this, that there was in the Spanish conquistadors' writings, they talked about whether the Spanish saw it or the Inca told them the story, that the giants were on this hill and all of a sudden the sky opened up and this angel with a flaming something or other just struck them all down dead. Now, that's in the book, and Tim read that. So do I believe it's real? Of course I do. It's right in my wheelhouse. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterwards. So in our work in the Watchers series, which is a video, Watchers 10, the last one that Richard and I actually did together, except for Best of Watchers, we broke the story on the Kandahar giant, which was a 12-footer found in Afghanistan. I was contacted by the deep state and warned not to go there. I mean, threatened basically, three different ways, threatened by the deep state. They didn't want the information out. Now it seems like they don't care about anything, so who knows?
Can you talk a bit about the Kandahar giant?
That's what that was. Richard was on a show, Richard Shaw, the director, and oh, wow, these pants have just about had it, bummer. Focus, LA, focus. Richard Shaw was a director and co-producer of all of our Watchers series. And Rick was on a radio show. And at the end of the show, a guy was held over because it was an interesting conversation. And he wanted to talk to Rick off camera or off air. And so he said, look, I'm a ex-military guy. I was a contractor and paid to do what I do. And I was in Kandahar and I was part of a team and we shot a 12-footer. So Rick immediately connects me with him. I interviewed him 3 times and once in person because he lived in Ohio before we brought him out and put him on camera. And the story goes that there was a hit piece on this a couple of weeks back by some goofy writer who, you know, just twisted everything and, because they don't want the information out. Well, you didn't talk to the witnesses I did. okay? And we have two witnesses. How many witnesses do you have? None. You're just writing a hit piece because you don't like what we discovered, because the powers that be don't like what we discovered, because they're trying to make it seem like, oh, this is fake news, when it's not fake news. How dare you? This guy, when I talked to him, every single time he got to the same part of the story, he broke down and wept. It was visceral. I'm a student of body language. Now, I just by looking at you, I can tell that you're focused, that you're serious. A lot of this you've never heard before, and you're pondering it. You're trying to fit it into your worldview. Just by looking at you right now, I'm a student of body language. When I interviewed the so-called shooter, I watched this guy like a flipping hawk. Are you kidding me? I watched him like a hawk. Was his eyes darting around? Was he moving his head? Was he moving his body like this, turning away from me? What was he doing? Every single time, boom, eyes locked on the mine. He gets to the part where Dan is killed and he starts to weep. He breaks down every single time. On camera, did the same thing. So a patrol goes missing in the early days of the Afghan conflict. They're up around in the Kandahar province looking for high value targets in caves. Specifically, that's what they're looking for. So this one patrol goes out, dropped off by a chopper, starts doing its thing, and they missed their rally point. They missed their second rally point. A rally point is when they radio in, hey, we're at such and such, you know, they've all got GPS things. Here we are, blah, blah, blah. Great, proceed cautiously, over and out. And they move on to the next rally point. They missed all their rally points. So the next morning, another chopper was dispatched, dropped them off roughly in the same area, and they begin to follow the trail. So they find themselves, the second patrol, coming down this like goat trail onto like a cliff a couple thousand feet above the valley floor. To the left of them is what appears to be a very large cave, but the cave is elevated above them. So they're proceeding cautiously because they're seeing bits of equipment and bits of what looks like human flesh. So they're not sure what's going on as they get onto this flat plateau area, which is basically like a cliff ledge, but it's got room, maybe 20, 30 feet before the edge of the cliff. So they're all spread out and they're moving. This 12 footer, flaming red hair, six fingers, double rows of teeth, comes screaming out of the cave, brandishing a very large lance, a spear, very large lance. And everyone just freezes. This is like your nightmare. You know, this is like something that just can't be real, and yet it is real. And so Dan, the guy's name, begins to, you know, run at this thing and fire his weapon. Well, the giant takes off with such agility and speed that everyone is taken aback. Before anyone can do anything, the giant has got his lance through. Dan has held him up over his head and screaming. And someone goes, shoot him in the head, shoot him in the head. And the rest of the patrol opens fire. And they basically almost decapitate this thing. Boom, he falls to the ground. At that point, you know, everyone's freaked out. Dan's still alive. They radio in for a chopper, a medical chopper. So, you know, it takes a while. Dan succumbs to his wounds. The chopper doesn't get there quick enough. And frankly, it was mortal anyway. Not much he could do. And unbelievable. And immediately they overwhelmed by the sense that the stench coming from this thing. It according to Dan, it was like rotting corpses. Now, I've never smelled a rotting corpse, but I imagine it would be incredibly nauseating. And he said some people did lose their lunch. Others were just, everyone was gagging. Red hair, double rows of teeth, because they could see into his mouth because of, you know, his head was shot off. They could see the double rows of teeth. Six fingers, six toes. And the chopper came and they loaded up Dan and they loaded up the giant in a separate chopper. They took a net, they put him in the cargo net. When they got back to the base, they all wrote their report. Then they were told, rewrite your report. And they did. They had to rewrite it until it was acceptable. So that's his story. We went with it because we had a second witness. We had a second witness who was there several years after the events. And in the cave fighting training that they were doing, they were told to raise your weapon higher. Well, why are we raising our weapon higher? Never mind, but just raise your weapon higher. Raise it up around 10 feet. Why was that being told? And this man told me that rumors on the base, all through the base, about the Kandahar giant that was killed, but you weren't supposed to talk about it.
It's remarkable. And in terms of that story, you mentioned some of the physical elements that giants are associated with: the red hair, the double rows of teeth, the sixth digit, and all those were there. And you mentioned then earlier around Catalina Island, some of the skeletons were found there. Do they exhibit the same features?
Well, there's the giant right behind me right there. Mm-hmm. So when we went back to the museum, there's the book that I published right there. Okay.
Yeah.
It's on the trail of a Nephilim. It's, what is it, 600 pages, 300 photos? It's an oversized book, as you can see, 8.5 by 11. Mm-hmm. So the shot that you're looking at is right here. And let me just get it to you. There's the original picture. It's a picture of the original picture that I took.
Right.
And you
okay,
can see,
yeah,
in front of Ralph, there's something pretty large there.
Yeah, it's big.
Well,
yeah.
I had three different researchers look at this thing and weigh in on it. We know that Ralph was 5'8".
Mm-hmm.
There's the original picture. So we take Ralph out of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one particular researcher took the skeleton out.
Right.
And then we put them both together. And basically what you wind up with is this.
Right.
That's a 9-footer.
Yeah.
That's a 9-footer. So when I published the book, we went back to the museum 6 months later because it was a whole hit piece, mm-hmm, on Ralph Glidden. Oh, they're going to take him to the cleaners. And they did. So there's my picture right there, yeah, of Ralph. What's wrong with that picture? It was blown up like 18 inches by a foot on the wall. So there's the original picture. What they did is they cropped the giant out of the picture. So once again, this is science. Science is supposed to go where the truth is. Science does not fudge the facts to promulgate a certain paradigm or a certain narrative. Science goes where it is led by the truth. That's not the truth. That's called a cover-up. That's called a deliberate obfuscation of something that is true. Now, to their credit, in the new museum, the real picture is there. They've blown it up like 4 feet by 3 feet. It's huge. But did they tell you what you're looking at? Of course not. Did they reference L.A. Marzulli's work? Of course not. I was on a History Channel in search of a lost giant with the Vieira brothers for their final episode. They were only on one season because, you know, there's search for the lost giants. Well, they never find anything because you can't find anything because they're never going to let you find anything. That's how that works. And, you know, I've been on archaeological digs. The closest that we've come is with the Paraca skulls right behind me. And that's episode 7 of our On the Trail of the Nephilim series, which you can download instant gratification by going to streaming.lamarzulli.net. Streaming.lamarzulli.net. That's episode 6 about the DNA, the conclusive research on the DNA. And we did that. Our team put that together. Our team did that. And in the film, you'll see archaeologists, anthropologists, medical doctors, surgeons, optometrists, chiropractors, a whole, you know, a cadre of people, multidisciplinary approach to what we're looking at here. And all of them say that this isn't human. Whatever this is, it's not a human being, it's something else. And so, you know, our team was the only team to date that has really delved into it. Apparently, according to Brian Forrester, there was a team that came down, they took samples, they did get nuclear DNA, then they made their own film on it, you know, and it was on Gaia. I'm trying to see it, if I can watch it one time to see what I'm looking at, because they did get nuclear DNA. And according to Brian, unknown primate, nothing in the gen bank, unknown primate, which is exactly fits my wheelhouse. Of course, it's going to be an unknown primate because it's fallen angel technology. They're mixing the seed. How do I know this? When you go back to the very first pages of the biblical prophetic narrative, the guidebook of a supernatural, and you sit down and you read, there's a scenario. And in that scenario, once again, we have the pre-incarnate Christ. You got Adam and Eve over here. You might not believe in the mythos, that's fine. And you got the dragon, the serpent over here. So Jesus is addressing everybody. When was the last time you heard this story? And he turns to the dragon and he says, your seed, your offspring, and I'm not making this up. Go back and look at it yourself. Genesis 3:15, it starts the whole deal. If you don't understand Genesis 3:15, you'll never understand anything else in the Bible. You won't. You won't understand what you're looking at. You'll have no idea unless you come to grips with Genesis 3:15. So Jesus says to the dragon, your seed, your offspring, will be at enmity, at war with the offspring of the woman. She will crush your head, or I'm sorry, the offspring of the woman will crush the dragon's head. The dragon will bruise the offspring's heel. That's the whole biblical story right there. That's it, the whole deal. And so it's a seed war. Three chapters later in Genesis 6, we have the eruption of the Nephilim, which were on the earth in those days and also afterwards, when the sons of God, the fallen angels, saw the women of earth, took them as wives, had coitus with them, and created this hybrid entity known as the Nephilim. And this is the kicker. It's happening right now in modernity. There's a book, the book of Daniel, found in the biblical prophetic narrative, where one of the good guys, one of the good angels, tells Daniel, hey, Dan, seal this book up until the time of the end. Seal it up. People will read it and they won't know what they're reading until the time of the end. There's a scripture in there. There's a line or two in there. It says this, their seed will mingle with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave to them. What does that mean? Who is they? If their seed is mingling with the seed of men, we're talking about rhinoceros seed? No. Penguin seed? No. We're talking about the days of Noah seed. We're talking about the fallen angelic host, once again, mingling their seed, but there's no cleaving. Cleaving is marriage. That's what happened in Genesis 6. Now there is no marriage. They're just mingling the seed. Look at the modern day alien abduction phenomena and the creation of hybrid beings, which people have seen. It's in our free film, UFO, 70-year-old cover-up, The Coming Great Deception of a Luciferian Angel. This is the book, but the film is free on my YouTube channel, L.A. Marzulli. The film is free. Why? Because the information is too important to charge for it. Number two in the series will be free. Number three and four, we're going to have to pay for it because we need to make some money here, keep the lights on. So all this is my worldview. It's my wheelhouse. I've dedicated my life. I've dedicated over 30 years to this. And my research goes back to when I was 16 and reading, you know, Edward Billy Meyer, not Meyer, that came later, that's in my 20s, UFO Contact from the Pleiades. But, you know, Peter Tonkin's Secrets of the Great Pyramid, Carlos Castaneda, Silver Mind Control, Uspensky. I mean, all that, I was immersed in that stuff. I had a guru, my third eye was open. I meditated, I joined the ashram. I've had spirit guides on the other side. And then at 30, I met the creator. It was like a Paul on the road to Damascus thing. And everything changed, my whole paradigm changed. But, you know, that's got to decline. That's the story.
Remarkable. Thank you for sharing all of that. And so there's two things I'd like to ask you. I'm conscious of time, but I'd like to ask you one about the Paracas skulls. And you have one. Is that a real one or a model?
No,
model?
You cannot take the real one out. Otherwise, yeah. You know.
I can imagine you'd be in trouble. Yes.
So here it is. First of all, it's not a giant.
Yeah.
So what am I looking at? What is this? We know that when Joshua and Caleb are given a mandate by the God of the Bible to wipe out every man, woman, child, animals, and burn everything. Well, people like Richard Dawkins go, see, the God of the Old Testament. he's wicked, he's evil. Well, maybe, but the moment you plug in the Nephilim, which Mr. Dawkins knows nothing about, everything changes. Everything right. changes. It says that the Nephilim were there. Why are they there? Mm-hmm. I wrote about this in my book, The Cosmic Chess Match. There's move, counter move, all throughout the timeline. Mm-hmm. So this is a Paraka skull. Is it a giant? No, absolutely not. Let's walk through it. Look at the orbits. Mm-hmm. The orbits are 25 to 30% larger than a human being. Look at the forehead. Right? Look how it slants back. Look how big it is. Mm-hmm. Look at the fact that there's absolutely no sagittal suture. Mm-hmm. These are called sutures right here. Okay? There should be a suture that goes from right here all the way to the back here. Mm-hmm. There is none. There's not even a vestige of it. Nothing. Mm-hmm. No trace of a sagittal suture, which in a human being divides the parietal parts.
Yeah.
Parietal plates here and here. Look at the front. Look at the orbs. Mm-hmm. Look at the massive jaw. Look at the pronunciation, the boldness of the zygomatic arch here. The kicker, and this was found by Rick Woodward. Rick Woodward was an anthropologist on our team, and he wrote a paper on it. And it was Rick's work. Other people have looked at this, but it's Rick Woodward who put it on the map. Woodward gets all the credit. Nobody else does. This is called the foramen magnum right here. Mm-hmm. Now, what you're looking at, when Joe Taylor molds this, he makes a mold inside the foramen magnum so he can put his dowel in there. Got it? Yeah. That's not what it looks like. The area around that is what the foramen magnum looks like. The foramen magnum on a normal human skull should be right about there in the center of the skull, right? To balance it. That's not what we see. The foramen magnum, if it's any further back, and you can see what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. if it's any further back, it's outside the skull. You can manipulate a skull through cranial deformation. You can mold it. I'm not saying you can't. We mm-hmm. know that they did that. You cannot move the foramen magnum from its resting place on a normal skull, which should be here, back all the way to the end, the rear of the occipital plate. Mm-hmm. You can't do it. It's an impossibility. It's a genetic anomaly, what we're looking at. A mm-hmm. genetic anomaly. This thing is, in my opinion, a Nephilim. It might be an Anakim, which means long neck. One of the tribes of a Nephilim were called the long necks. Why? Yeah. Because in order to balance this thing, you would have to have a longer neck to compensate for, otherwise he's like this. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, his head's always down. So is it a long neck? We don't know. We've never had a complete mummy. We've got, Brian Forrester has a line on one, and we're going to see if, you know, we can get down there. I would take an X-ray machine. I would take a forensic anthropologist. We've got money to do this because we're on the trail. We also know, when I was down in 2019 with Tim Alberino, he had an archaeologist that took us out into the reserve. Well, the public is not allowed out in the reserve. We went out in the middle of nowhere. And it's very barren. There's nothing grows there because there's no rain. It's like the Sahara Desert.
Right.
And we were there, and there was a little like a camp, a couple of makeshift tents with these with these fishermen, and they had camped right next to what was one of the Paracas skulls, 3,000-year-old dwelling place. And some of it was still intact. There was a chimney that went down into the earth, three stories, but we couldn't dig it out. See, if I had money, I'd be out there tomorrow digging the thing out.
Right, right.
Down and see what it looks like. But welcome to Peru, where nothing is ever done. A lot of talk, a lot of moving of paper, but nobody's in the field. Very few people are in the field. And, you know, anyway, I digress. But I said to the archaeologist, when you have exhumed some of these, did you find evidence of torchlight? In other words, how did they see down there? He said, well, we don't know. No, we found no evidence of torchlight. And we're not sure how they saw. Well, when you look at that skull that I just showed you, right there, those eye sockets are 25 to 30% larger. In episode 6 of On the Trail, we interviewed an optometrist who took one look at this thing and said, first of all, it's genetic. Second of all, this entity very possibly had night vision because the pupillary distance should be about 65 millimeters between pupils like mine are. These are much closer. These are 45 millimeters apart. So they probably had night vision. There's another Nephilim tribe called the Horites. It's listed in the Bible. That's translated cave dwellers. So you put two and two together, large eyes, cave dwellers, Anakim, long necks. Are we looking at a crossbreed between the two tribes? Possibly. Are we looking at the Anakim? Possibly. Are we looking at the Horites? Possibly. And now that we know that they got nuclear DNA, and the DNA was not human, it was not in the gen bank, right, that fits my narrative to a T. Mm-hmm. What we're looking at is the offspring of the fallen angels, in my opinion.
And then to build on that, for people who aren't familiar with the skulls, the volume of the cranium, the cavity, yeah, is far larger than ours.
Yeah. Yeah, 25 to 30% larger.
Yeah. That's correct. And again for listeners, with this skull, this is one of many and they all exhibit the same features. I think that's right. Worth sharing with listeners. Again, around the sutures, the volume, the size of the orbital socket, it's all, there's lots of repetition of the same things. One other point of interest, and maybe you can correct me on this if I've got this wrong, but has there also been samples of hair being found with these skulls?
Yeah, there are. We've done testing on the hair.
Yeah.
Which enables us, you know, the baby skull, which is right next to, right there, the little one, you can see it next to it. That we took hair and skin samples from that one. And we tested it at three different labs. And the testing came back U2E1, which is Eastern European. Well, that rewrites history. Mm-hmm. See, they don't like it. The archaeologists and the academics, they don't like it because it rewrites history. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's contaminated. Oh, really? So let me get this straight. We had lab suits, head-to-toe lab suits, okay? Double sleeves, gloves, glasses, hair nets, masks, paper boots over our boots, whole body suit. We would walk in, we would look, take the samples, Chase Klowski immediately tagged and bagged them, boom. Mm-hmm. So they come right off, bam, into the thing. Then when they brought another skull in, we would go out of the room, we would change our clothes into brand new lab suits. We had 40 different lab suits for each of us to wear, okay? Our protocols were stringent. And we took my DNA and Mondo's DNA. Mondo was our lead archaeologist in this endeavor. And we found one sample that was contaminated with my DNA, which we immediately threw it out. So out of the samples that we did, about 28 of them sequenced. Out of the sequencing, many of them, about half of them, showed a Middle Eastern / European origin. That rewrites history, but they don't like it because it's not the history that they want. It's not the paradigm that they're espousing. It's not the fact that Native Americans didn't know about the 18 and a half year lunar cycle, but they're going to build the octagon mound, which encompasses 50 acres and is based on the 50 or the 18 and a half year lunar cycle. And in 2025, I will be there, God willing, to film that because the moonrise comes right over the whole site. Right. And it comes over where the ceremony would take place. I mean, are you kidding me? And everywhere else, all these sites are built on an 18 and a half year lunar cycle. And it's going to be a very charged time, very charged time, because that's when these sites can be activated, if you know how to activate them, which I don't want to know.
Right. And then in terms of the genetic... markers are, you said, Eastern European, Middle Eastern. Is that what you said? Have there any been other skulls found in that areas of the world that have similar features?
Well, there are, but you know, the anthropologists, and see, this is what drives me nuts. I mean, they never turn the skulls over, which is to me the smoking gun. And then, you know, we found this elongated skull, and cradle headboarding was practiced by this tribe, blah, 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 blah. I can tell you what a cradle headboard is. All you got to do is turn the skull over. If the foramen magnum's in the middle, cranial deformation, cradle headboarding. If that foramen magnum is moved all the way back to the occipital plate, that's something else. That's genetic. That's not cranial deformation.
Mm-hmm. So it is extremely straightforward to tell the difference.
I think it is at this point. Mm-hmm. See, when we went down there in 2013, no one knew any of this. Mm-hmm. We didn't know. Brian Forrester didn't know. Rick Woodward, who never came down there, but we gave him all the plaster casts that we have. And he turned the skulls over, and that's when he said, L.A., this is genetic, and this here's your smoking gun. Mm-hmm. It was Rick Woodward's work as our anthropologist on our team who discovered that.
And so intriguing. Absolutely fascinating. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm working on another book. It's number 14. I can't tell you the title, but I'm working on number 14, and I'm working on three more UFO films in the series. So there'll be four in the series, and then I'm working on number 8 in the On the Trail series. So I'm really busy, and I got conferences coming up. The next one is in Dallas on March 17th to the 21st, or the 20th rather, here the Watchman Conference, and we'll have something up on our website pretty soon on that. So that's it.
Wonderful. Well, LA, it's been fascinating talking to you. I really appreciate you taking the time, and
thank you.
And wish you the best with your upcoming publications and filming.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Told you. Wow. I mean, I have to admit, I absolutely love the whole Giants narrative. I find it so engaging and entertaining. So I really love that territory. Wild. Absolutely wild. The skull is remarkable. The Paracas skulls really blow my mind. I've known about them for a long time because I've seen some of the Watchers shows back in the day. But yeah, there you go. Ancient giants, a separate line from humanity. Well, look, I talk about fairies half the time and gin. Why not throw giants into the mix? I hope you all enjoyed that. Take care and talk soon.